Hello, truth seekers, and welcome to another episode of We Want the Truth. I'm Pierce, and today we are talking about the ever so intriguing topic of finance. Diving into the life of an e-commerce and wealth coach, this week we'll be sharing the truth on how to think about finance, diversifying and creating multiple income streams, and hopefully how to make money. For you truth seekers looking to learn or improve your finance skills, this is the episode for you. With that being said, let's get into this week's episode. This week, we have yet another incredible guest. She is currently a senior account executive at the largest e-commerce investor in the world, Clearco, and also a former founder of several startups from Reheart and Empower 10. Today, she's sharing her skills of finance and wealth with thousands of finance-focused individuals across TikTok, Instagram, and Clubhouse to help achieve their financial goals. And she is also a brand new homeowner. So this week, we have the one and only Vasiliki Belegrinas. Vasiliki, how's everything going with you today?
Good. Thank you so much for the wonderful introduction here, Pierce. It's a pleasure to be joining you here.
It's a pleasure to see you. It's been a hot sec since we've chatted. Like, what has it been? It's been a few months?
Yep. You've been in Australia. I've been in the UK. It's complete different time zones, but it's always a pleasure, you know, having the chance to see face-to-face since we basically started at Clearco the same day. So we've been together since day one.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny. I go to bed when you guys wake up. As soon as I see that you guys are online, I'm like, oh God, I need to go to bed. I should not be up this late.
Yeah. And it's the same thing that I do. Like once I see you're online, I tell myself, okay, now it's too late for me. I should be going to bed.
It's an interesting life we live. But needless to say, again, you just told me you bought a new home. How is that for you?
Yeah, it's an exciting time. I'm officially a first-time home buyer. I always had it on my vision board. I had it as a huge goal that I wanted to achieve before 30 years old. And here I am before turning 25. And I actually was able to solidify that just last night. It was probably the two craziest months of my life of home searching, but it was something that has been in the plans and in the works for like over a year and a half, and a whole lot of just diligent practice on my end to just save up, to do the right things, to prepare myself for mortgages and stuff that I'm happy to dive into a little bit later today, but super proud. I remember even writing myself a letter to my future self on my 25th birthday that I'll have the money to finally put a deposit, but here I am now with a house. Maybe I'll be moving in before my 25th birthday as well. So that'll be pretty sick.
Holy cannoli. That's incredible because I think it's everyone's dream to buy a home in their 20s. But obviously with how hot really the market is right now and how difficult it is just to be living with the pandemic. But would love to maybe throw it to you and start off by telling our listeners a bit more about who you are and really your focus in regards to finance.
Yeah, for sure. So like Pierce mentioned, I'm Vasiliki. If you can't tell from the name itself, I'm Greek, but I'm a proud Greek Canadian. So my parents are actually immigrants from Greece. They came to Canada, had absolutely no idea what it, like the finance world really have to comply with them. It was always, you know, work hard and then eventually you would have money in the side. It was very much like the immigrant mentality almost that you work until you're done. Me growing up in Canada, I have always had such a huge appreciation for my parents' work ethic. It's part of the reason why I think I work so hard myself. But it wasn't actually until my parents instilled a lot of great characteristics behind my own career where, you know, I witnessed that from when I was first born. Like my dad for the past 40 years was a blue-collared cleaner. I used to be embarrassed to say, but he literally cleaned toilets. And I remember always feeling very ashamed about it, but he actually provided so much opportunities for my sister and I. He gave us a house. He gave us food on the table. And I always felt like, how can I repay them? Because I see how much sacrifices that they sacrifice each and every day. And how can I actually repay them back? So I did what is like the typical like first gen thing. Go to business school, go do like everything top notch just to do to make them proud, to say like, on paper, I've done everything. I was going to go become an accountant. I was going to go and like work in like the big four, and quickly realize that, you know, you don't have to go through that exact path. There's many people working on so many different income per year that are doing better than others that are actually making more. And there's actually such a big mindset shift that you actually need to take. Instead of just making more money, it's actually like setting the example to yourself that even if you come from a blue collar family, even if you come from like an immigrant family, or you are first or even second gen, there are opportunities where you can break the generational wealth gap and actually start making a real difference in the wealth of your family much sooner on. I went to business school, was broke of a student, like paying for that kind of a structure of a schooling. And it wasn't until I actually started to teach myself finance and personal finance more specifically that I realized I was doing a lot of the things wrong and most common mistakes that you can work as hard as you want, but it's actually more so working smart.
And it's interesting as well, because I know you've told me that story before, and it's instilled such great traits in you, hard worker, driven, but also just very empathetic and understanding, which is why you definitely succeed in finance, of course, but as well, even at Clearco, like your performance is top notch. Staying in line with that as well, it seems like you've taken a lot of control of like your finance, again, just buying a house at 25, like it's something unthinkable for most of us. I'd be curious for you to share, how has taking control of your finances influenced your career and really your day-to-day decisions in life?
Mm-hmm. First of all, it's not easy to take control of your finances. Like, I remember thinking that I was so on top of my game, the fact that I was in business school, I was working at this big four, I was doing internships, I was doing like everything possible, working these big global 500 companies. And I thought I made it. And no, because I made it, like I can spend like as if I've made it. So I actually remember when I was at like my so-called like peak that I thought was my peak of my career, even though I was literally like still in school or just freshly graduated, that was such a flawed mentality. It wasn't actually until I was in credit card debt, building my own company from scratch, that I realized like, this is actually very flawed. And yes, like I have aspirations. Yes, I want to build an incredible company. And yes, I want to actually work for a Fortune 500 company. It's more so, how can you actually get back to the roots of staying realistic as you're growing? I think a lot of the times people fall into the trap like, oh, there's a certain image you need to uphold if you're working at like at a certain kind of like level of a company or such, or like it's very easy to just get lost in the fact that all of a sudden you're making money and you have credit card access and you have the world's oyster. And unfortunately, like growing up, like I also witnessed that, like it was very much a paycheck to paycheck kind of living. And so I just thought it was always normal that, oh yeah, whatever you make, you spend. Like there's no such thing as savings. And then on top of it, just like the whole fascination that I'm young, like I'm going to go have shopping sprees. And there's nothing wrong with that. And there's absolutely nothing wrong in buying pleasures and like treating yourself. But it's actually just doing it in a way that's actually realistic and where you are still setting things aside for you to actually achieve your financial goals, which to be honest, like I never sat down with myself and told me what my financial goals are. Even when I went through university, I never had the goal of buying a house at 24. I was like, that's something like, oh, when I get married eventually. But then there's a rude awakening of, you know, just figuring out like, how do you want to navigate through life? Mm-hmm. And that the rude awakening that happened to a lot of people was actually just COVID in itself. Mm. And that made a huge reality check to many people. And I just quickly realized like beforehand that the path that I was leading to even before, like since graduating university, wasn't getting me that far. And I had to change the way that I was actually like thinking about money. Because it's very easy for someone with like 120K income to actually have less money at the end of the day of someone who's making like 40 or even 60. Mm-hmm. Like it's very easy if you don't take control of everything. So instead of being actually afraid to invest and instead of being afraid to actually open the conversation behind personal finance, it's really just hitting it head on and just at least entertaining the idea of it and how it's actually transformed so many different lives. So it wasn't until I did that I started to actually write down my goals and start taking things seriously.
And I think that's a big thing for us as well. Like we're in our early 20s. We think we're invincible, as you said. And it's the first time we're actually getting paid what I would like to say real money for our service. That's ultimately it. But I think as well, as you'd mentioned, a lot of people have big aspirations. They want the Bugatti. They want the mansion. They want whatever they want. But as you've already said, you know, you really need to tackle this head on. I think as our generation, there's a lot of hesitancy in regards to trying to to enter this world of finance because there's terminology, there's processes, and there's just so many different ways to make money that it's almost overwhelming. I guess my next question for you would be, what would you say to those individuals who are in that state to help ease their nerves about trying to delve into the space more?
Yeah. And before even answering that question, I totally understand the hesitancy because I literally was a victim. Like a lot of people, even when they're like still in their 60s and 70s, they still are hesitant. But I think it just comes down to the reality. Like you were mentioning like people want to have like the Bugattis, people want to have the luxury items. Sometimes it's not even like, it doesn't even need to be that extreme. You can blow $10,000 in a year so easily.
Yep.
And I'll give a quick example. You only need to spend $27.40 a day to blow $10,000 a year. And actually, your previous, Hamza was in your previous podcast. Me and him actually had a conversation about this. And I shared this to my story, like that exact fact one time. I shared like, it only takes $27.40 a day to blow $10,000 a year. And he literally responded back to me. He's like, can I swear?
You can do whatever you want.
So he literally responded to me. He's like, oh shit, I literally spend that much on Uber Eats every single day. Like I'm literally burning money. And it's just like those small things. Or even if you kind of put into like a week's perspective, like one shopping trip at the end of the week, you literally are blowing away money that, yeah, it's fun. But did you realize that it accumulates very quickly? It's the same reason why subscriptions, it's so easy to love subscriptions, but they add up over time. So I think that hesitancy really just comes to the fact that people automatically think that, okay, I have to let go of things. I have to learn personal finance. I have to learn how to invest. I have to do all those things. It's really not that complicated. Like people overcomplicate it. And the other thing is that the hesitancy is that people feel like, oh, but I don't have like $1,000 or $10,000 I want to invest. Like if I'm going to do this, I want to make money instantly. The other question becomes like, well, if you're not comfortable with putting down $100 or even $1,000, how are you going to be comfortable putting down $10,000 into investing when you're just starting out? I remember, and I'm not ashamed to say this, like for a good majority, like when I first started beginning investing, which wasn't even like a crazy time ago, because I really only started getting into it maybe like around 20, 21 years old. Maybe consider late to some people. There is no such thing as late. Once you start, you start. But I remember like, I just started with like $100. And for me, the biggest indicator for me to understand when I should start putting more of my hard-earned money was to look at the percentage differences. People are always like, oh, but I want to make like $2,000 in a day. But if you only put, for example, like if you put $1,500 or $1,800 and you only made $200, you can say like, oh, you have a $2,000 stock portfolio. Or obviously this is a dramatic example. Mm-hmm. You can say that you put $100 into the stock market and you made $2,000. Obviously it's very dramatic, yeah. But that's just kind of the example I'm trying to put, that you have to first understand how the market operates, react to the dips, and then decide, is this something that you can handle? And if you even want to be that active, because I wanted to be more active. I wanted to slowly put in $100 here, $100 there until it grew into a more sizable portfolio and where I felt comfortable putting that much more money into it. That's another part of it. Like you can do that, which requires a bit more learning and more hesitancy, or you can just literally do what is like robo advisors, which is basically you put in money and the robots behind like these programs like Wealthsimple Invest or like Questrade has a robo advisor as well. There's so many different robo advisors. They more or less average like a 12 to 13% return every year, which is far higher than inflation. If you rather get like 0.01% on your savings account, or at max you get a high interest, maybe 1.5, which is probably only provided for a limited time moving forward as well. Would you rather make 0.1 cents or would you rather make 12 to 13? Because yes, it's going to have ups and downs throughout every single day, every single month. Over the long term, if your investment hypothesis or if your timeline does allow you, the stock market has always shown that you can have it for the longer term. So my question is actually, why be hesitant on something that's actually proven to actually like always outbeat inflation, or just actually have your money lose its value? Because 0.01% is much lower than the inflation rate. And to kind of put that into perspective, why did a chocolate bar like 50 years ago cost like a few cents? Now it can go upwards like $10, even $30. Here's if you're getting something luxurious, right? So that's the whole point. Like that's what inflation does. So if you want $1,000 to be worth $900 by the following year or 2-3 years, like, or you want it to be worth above $1,000 because it's going to be in the stock market outbeating inflation, that's where you have to realize it's actually more hesitant to leave your money under a bed. that pretty much wraps up that question as well. That, you know, which one are you actually more comfortable with?
Yeah, and I think it comes back to like challenging the status quo. Do you want to really make money, or what's your hesitancy here? But I will say, when you talked about that dramatic example of like $100 going to $2,000, I did instantly think of what happened with GameStop.
Yeah, me too. That was like, I shouldn't make that reference, but for the illustrative purposes.
Did you get into that GameStop action while it was happening, or no?
I was too scared to be in the GameStop world because honestly, I've never witnessed anything like that. Like, again, like the people who probably made money on that, like, was by chance. Like, let's be honest, like the stock market is not a casino and people mistreated it thinking that it was. But I actually made money off of AMC because I felt like it was a much different price point. Like, I got in at AMC at $4 versus when GameStop was like already at $300. So $4 versus $300, like, I can burn $100 and just have for the fun of it, just to say that I was part of the downfall of hedge funds and such. Much more fun to witness the whole movement of people waking up to the idea of like inaccessibility of investing. That's the biggest plus that I saw from this entire thing. People really started to want to learn about getting started with the stock market. It's had its pros and cons because people literally have lost a lot of their life savings. I saw people take out like second mortgages out of their house. It's a very scary thing when you're not done with delicacy. But on the positive side, like, it did bring to light there are more ways to make money and there are opportunities really in every corner. It was a pretty interesting time.
You're turning 25 this year. You've done a lot. I'd be curious to hear if you could go back and talk to yourself at the BM University, what would be sort of like maybe the top like two or three things you would tell yourself at that time to maybe reshape your life, however you want to answer that question?
If I was to go back to the beginning of university, I was actually the first in my family to go to university. So everything was new to us. Everything was, what's an OSAP? Like, what am I doing here? Like, where am I going to take my career after this? Like, I knew at the end of the day, in the back of my mind, like, my dad has always like told me, like, become a CPA, like, look with our accountant, like, his entire family is so incredible because they're all CPAs and they live so well. And the value that I got, it was comfort. And the fact that like they live comfortably, like, they understand money. And that was the biggest thing that I took out of it. Like, I want to understand money. When I look back to my first day of university, I just wish I would have taken more chances with starting earlier. Everyone says this, but honestly, like, I did start early still at like 20, however old I was with investing. But compounding is such a beautiful, magical thing. It's probably the only magic that's real in this world. And I graduated in 2018, but I started university in 2014. If I started really investing from 2014 to now, that would have been 7 years of compound interest. And 7 years versus like three or four is like more than double or almost a double. That makes a big difference. But then it also makes me think, like, in the future, like, wow, like, this is such a beautiful thing. Imagine the possibilities, like, when I have children, like, there's like certain things that you can do where you can give the names off to, if you make a specific portfolio under your name, when your child turns 18, you can pass the account over in their name, whatever. Like, just imagine the compound interest over 18 years and like they didn't have to lift a finger. Like, and it could have just been like birthday money, like nothing crazy, like birthday money, like not you going out of your way, putting like $500 every single month into that account. Like, simple things. That's the first thing for sure. Like, starting earlier, getting my life together and just understanding the value of stock market and like the potential of opportunities there and just not ignoring it. I remember always thinking like, oh, until I graduate business school, like, I won't understand finance and I won't get into it. But that's a very flawed mentality. Like, investing is not meant just for like the rich of the rich. It can be really accessible to everyone. And the second thing, which is a little controversial, is that I wish that I was not afraid of the OSAP. The OSAP is probably the best things that it could happen for anyone. And if you're eligible for it, you should take it. I had to take OSAP. And I remember being scared, so scared, because it was my first technical loan. Yeah. And I had no idea how I was going to repay it at the end of the 4 years, because I'm not a rich kid, like trust fund. I don't have mommy and daddy's rich bank account to pay it off for me. It was just more so like, okay, over these next 4 years and when 2018, when I graduate and the interest starts kicking in, like, what am I going to do? Like, I remember just being scared of it entirely. But that was such a flawed mentality, because there's a huge difference between bad debt and good debt. It took me a while to understand that OSEP was actually very good debt. It built my credit score. Like, I have incredible credit score for my age. It's extremely low interest in comparison to like other lines of credits or loans that you can have attached to your name. And it's actually such a useful way to literally build your credit. While you can actually be using your money in a way where you don't need to pay off however much your schooling was immediately, and you can put into other areas. What I mean by that is that I remember right when I graduated, there was such a huge pressure on me that I put on myself, and that I heard from other people saying like, oh, you have to pay off OSEP as soon as you can, like, don't have the interest, don't have, you don't want to have monthly expenses, blah blah blah. And I remember like feeling so nervous because like I was building my own company at the time. I didn't have like reoccurring income in the way that I wanted to, and so I was freaking out. But as I was just doing like the minimum payments, like, because I actually like looked into it more, I was like, that's actually the best thing you can do, just do the minimum payments, because your OSEP actually has a taxable credit to it. And we know this from ClearCo that time value money is the most important thing. So if you know that, and you, instead of you paying $1,000, $2,000 a month to pay something off in like a year or less, you can actually be diversifying that $1,000 to $300 goes to your OSEP, and your other $800 goes towards investing. That's actually going to pay off your OSEP while you're making money. So it's just being strategic with your money. It's diversifying in a way where if you know you can invest in something that has a higher return than the interest rate, you should always be leveraging that. And that's where OSAP is not the scary thing. Obviously, there are shark student loans, but look at the interest rate. If it makes financial sense, there's a way for you to actually take advantage of these kinds of opportunities while building your credit. So it was such a win-win. I'm not ashamed to say, like, I still pay OSAP because it's something that I leverage in my own toolkit. Those are the two biggest things I would say. Start early and leverage financial tools like OSAP.
And for you listeners, OSAP is an Ontario-based student loan service. So for anyone who may not be out of Ontario, it might not apply to you. But if you are in Ontario and are looking to go to university or going back to university, something to definitely look into. I'll put some more information below. I think you gave a really great segue in regards to diversification. TikTok, through Instagram, through Clubhouse, as I already mentioned, like you've gone on a lot of different chats talking about financing from a ClearCo perspective, but as well talking about personal wealth, as we've been talking already, stocks, real estate, doing your own startups or service. I would love for you to maybe talk about the different income streams people should be thinking about to set them up for future success, what else they should be thinking about to diversify their assets, build more money, et cetera.
Yeah, for sure. This is a topic that I personally love because it's something that I personally like value so much. I heard this quote a while ago, and I'm probably going to butcher it a bit, but it goes along the lines that, you know, having just one income stream is one too close towards poverty, and just like being left with nothing and being left with no income. And it really struck a chord because many people, and like growing up, like the norm was just having your one 9-to-5 job. Like I witnessed it with my parents, where like they were cleaners. If they lost a contract, it was a loss of income entirely. And it's a very scary thought because you have to make it up and you're left in a time of stress. And those are not the kinds of moments that you want to be begging and looking for jobs and contracts. So I did a few internships. It was great having 9-to-5. But I always remember being like, after like I got my paycheck, after taxes, everything else, like, is this life? Is this really life? Like, this is why I'm working like so many hours and this is what I'm left with. It was a huge like eye-opening experience to me, being like, this can't be the only way that I make money. There are like 30 to 31 days in a month, and if this is what my time is worth, then I need to do something about it. It goes back to what we were saying earlier. It only takes $27.40 a day to burn $10,000. But then also, if you flip it on reverse, it also only takes $27.40 a day to earn $10,000. Mm-hmm. So even as small as doing a side hustle, even working with like affiliates, starting off an e-com store, anything and everything, like coaching, like there's so many things for you to actually diversify your own income, and you can build yourself a pretty credible additional income source. So I do have like multiple income streams. It's something that gives me that peace of mind. Although of course my 9-to-5 is still the chunk of my income. I still know that, okay, if I have a cell phone expense, that's covered from this little hobby that I do. If I want to go get my nails done, that's covered from this other like affiliate thing that I do. Like there's certain things where like you can now take away like frivolous expenses, sunk costs that you have. And then from your 9-to-5, keep the bulk of it and keep the majority of it. So very common income streams that really anyone can have and start off with, like without having a big audience, without having to do anything very extreme, is like obviously your 9-to-5. And having a 9-to-5 for me is really important. Like even if I'm like crushing it in like my monthly income, like it's very important that I still have that security and that stability as well. all, but you can go into like dividend investing, which is a whole other topic of investing in stocks that actually give you either like monthly, quarterly income. It's very little depending on how much you make, but it's still something. Then you can go like into affiliate marketing, and affiliate marketing is also very simple. It's as simple as just like having a referral code and you made $20. Did that $20 pay for my phone bill? Maybe. Probably did. If you send it to a few friends, it literally covers the entire thing. Or you can go into like cashback credit cards. Did it save me another expense of doing my nails? Probably did. Did it cover me getting a haircut? Probably did as well. There's another income stream just using high interest savings accounts. I'm a big believer before you in touch investing, you need to have an emergency fund. And my emergency fund is put into a high interest savings account where it pays me like $30, $40 a month, which is like beautiful. Again, it covers another one of like my Netflix subscription. It covers like my Spotify subscription. These are just simple things to cross out expenses. And so my best way when I talk about income streams is like write down your income. And write down all the monthly expenses you have, no matter what. And then what you want to kind of have is like for your own pleasure. And if you can basically have an income source for each of those, or like you don't need to have 5,000 income streams for the 5,000 expenses. It's can this income stream cover this plus this and all this? And then at that point, then you're starting to actually build a passive income stream where you don't need to really lift a finger, such as like the cashback, such as like the interest that you're going to be getting your savings. Then you can go into something more like more active income streams. Like I had like a drop shipping store in the past. Like my sister and I just for fun have like a little baking, like Instagram, which like has also been incredible and only has like 300 followers, but it's probably made more money than like a lot of other like Instagram accounts that pay for tens of thousands. So there's just such simple things that people can be doing. That $27.40 a day makes a huge, huge difference. And it's as simple as just breaking it down that simple that doesn't make it look as daunting. Because one other final point I'll make is that a lot of people think that you need to automatically have like 10K in passive income. Like, let's be realistic. Like, if you're having 10K in passive income, there's probably a larger audience behind this. But also, it took time. It's not an easy, quick thing to build passive income. It requires a lot of effort. And the goal is not to have like 20 income streams at all, like $10. The goal is that you're actually adding income streams that are bringing value and are adding more dollars to your time. Because if it's not, then you can brag about having 20 income streams, but if your time is divided into 20 different directions, you can't prioritize anything. That's also not good. That's how I like to think about income streams. I am proud that I've had like diversified myself in a way, but it's never going to be perfect. And I'm always figuring out ways how to optimize certain income streams, how to cross out other ones, and just keep a fresh tab on it at all times.
Interesting. Yeah. And I think you make a lot of good points, right? Anything in life, like starting a sport, starting a business, heck, maybe even just like asking someone else, like you just got to do it. And that's like the biggest thing. You just got to go head first and fail fast and grow quickly. Like as we all know, I guess maybe the next question I'd like to ask you again, it's very daunting even as we speak for probably some of our listeners. What kind of like resources would you recommend or places to go for people to get more information on how to invest? How to drop ship, like all these different income streams that you've utilized and that you would recommend to other people?
Yeah, this is a really great question because I actually get this quite a lot. People are always asking like, oh, but how can I get started? How can I do this? And like, but then they get scared thinking that they need to invest like thousands of dollars into coaching. Honestly, I'm a very like bootstrappy person. YouTube is my best friend. There are so many free resources. Like if you want to build up a drop shipping or e-commerce store, Shopify has an entire Compass app that tells you from A to Z how to do it. Facebook also has free resources, how to learn Facebook ads, which is probably like the one thing that's so underutilized because everyone is paying people to learn how to do Facebook ads. Obviously it comes with like with training, but like my point is like just to begin, there are free resources. And using the free resources is what's going to give you the confirmation that you actually want to do this. I'm not a Facebook ads expert. I'm not that big of a fan, but I love building sites. I didn't need to pay $5,000 for someone to make me a true, true expert in Facebook ads. Instead, I did some free resources, realized, okay, like this is an interesting thing and I definitely want to learn Facebook ads. But for now, I really just wanted to get really good at like Shopify building and like website building and like design and all of that. That's something that I'm more leaning towards. And then that's something that like, okay, I'll put 1,000 in coaching, like whatever it is type of thing. So I follow people on Instagram that are also constantly talk about investing, like what's happening in the market. Mm-hmm. And the biggest hack has also been like, not just educating, but filtering. You can learn as much as you want. You can watch as many YouTube videos as possible. But there's also the second part of taking action. And mm-hmm. that part of action is the first step for me was filtering. I would teach the YouTube algorithm that I want to no longer see like beauty makeup routines or like what's happening with like TikTok influencers showing up on my home feed. I would manually push and say, hide this kind of content and this type of related content. And I only want my home feed to be something that adds value to my life. So I want to see what, when like Graham Stephen is posting, when Griffin Milks is posting, like, cause these are relevant content that I can take actionable steps from. It's a very small life change. Same thing on my Instagram. Whenever I see Instagram content that really adds no value, like I love travel videos, so I'll keep those. But if I'm following like Kim Kardashian, like it's amazing to see the empire she built, but I'm done with the selfies type of thing as well. So just unfollowing, like having that cadence of just like filtering things out, which is up to date, but it's also just good for your mental health. Yeah. To like declutter, to be focused on what's really important for you as well. So I'm very conscious about that. And obviously like from those filtering, then you start to be motivated because you see people having those results. You're seeing people, their moves, and it's not rocket science. Like a lot of it is also just like getting inspiration, seeing what they're doing. And if you think it's the same hypothesis that you have, like you can do the same. So it's really as simple as just, you know, having that mental shift, filtering and like taking the action from there.
I think Google and YouTube are just your best friends, like really for any type of research, for any type of building. Because again, like you had also mentioned prior to this, now that I'm thinking about it, like Facebook, you can learn how to do Facebook ads, Facebook for free, Google, you can do the exact same thing. And, you know, as we both know, like anytime, even if you're starting a business or doing anything else, those are the two biggest platforms to promote yourself, your business, whatever it may be. Even if you are like a business influencer, affiliate, whatever it is. I would also like to maybe take this time because we talked a lot about now different resources, different income streams you can have. What are some maybe myths about multiple income streams that you can debunk for us now?
The biggest myth behind income streams is what I touched upon a little bit earlier in the sense that there's no such thing as bragging about how many income streams you have. You can have 3 solid income streams and like live fabulously, or you can have 20, but there's a good chance that like if you have 20 income streams, like there's a very big difference from your top one to your bottom one, unless mm-hmm. you're like literally have a million followers and like even like an affiliate link, whatever, is going to still bring you hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
But that's like the biggest myth, that you need so many income streams and you need them all fast. It's like, no, start with one, get a good grip about it, see that it's working, so you have a motivation to make another one. Because when people rush and they want to do this and that, where they want to make e-com store while also, you know, invest so much money into dividend stocks, well, like, you need money for both, you need time for both, and you just overwhelm yourself. So just take it one by one. And the other thing is, that's the biggest myth, is that not every income stream is passive. It's actually like the complete opposite. An income store is not passive. YouTube channels are not passive. There are so many things that are not passive, and it requires a lot of upfront work. The majority of times, it always requires upfront work. Then it can be passive. But if you want to keep it going, like for e-com, like for YouTube, like for
podcasts
podcasts, you need to keep it going. It's not passive. So whenever you hear people say like, oh, I have 10 passive income streams, I'm like, is it passive? Is it actually passive? Because like, that's a very false narrative where everyone thinks that like they should be traveling 24/7 living on the beach. And that's like, that's such a false thing to make people very hopeful for, because it's obviously possible, but it's a lot harder than when people make it seem like, oh, passive income. And the reality is too, like passive income is not like that glamorous. Like I actually saw a joke recently where it's like, would you rather have $1 million today or put that all into a diversified portfolio and make $1 a month off your for the next 30 years with your dividend stocks? Like that's how ridiculous sometimes these passive income things sound, where it's like, great, you have so many, but if you only make $1 off of everything, like, is it really worth it? Like, become good at each stream, at each part that you really want to emphasize in, and then the money will flow.
I feel like we need to change the name of passive income, to change the terminology.
Yeah, it's sort of just income streams.
Just income streams, active income streams, or active Vasiliki streams.
Exactly.
I'm still working on that one, so we'll leave it at that. I think what's really interesting, you know, you've talked about your experience, you've talked about the multiple income streams that you use and that people do use. So I think coming back, and I know in your talks, you talk a lot about like mindsetting, and you've talked about it a little bit already. I would love for you maybe to just share top three things that you would recommend to people to start actively changing the way they think about money or investing, diversifying their assets. How that should they be rewiring or reshaping their brain to think about that?
Yeah, this is a really good question. I love anecdotes and I love stories. So the first one that I have is, and this is a quote that I found from one of my TikTok friends, so I'll credit to him. He basically made the point that for, and this is in the topic of investing, a lot of people get scared, and it kind of goes back to your earlier question of hesitancy when they're investing in stocks because they see the ups and downs. And when the market's crazy, like it has been since like everything, and it does go up and down, that's just the reality, that that's expected. And if you understand the market, like that's to be expected on a daily basis. But the question that everyone needs to ask themselves is that if you're investing to the stock market, you're putting, it's like you're planting a tree. You put the seed in and you want it to grow into a beautiful and luscious tree. But if you had some negative days, you had some red days, are you going to go dig up the seed, pull it up again to see if the roots are growing? The answer is obviously no. And it's the same mentality that you should have with investing. You put it in there. You have the hypothesis that in 2, 3, 5 years, it's going to grow into a beautiful, luscious tree with beautiful like apples. I don't know. And that's supposed to be the fruits of your labor. And like those apples can become like the dividends, like, and that are going to repay you, and you continue to grow and you continue to reinvest until you have this entire beautiful farm of trees, which are money grows on trees and it is your money. That's like the first thing. The other thing is like also, for example, like because I just bought the house, is also in relation to investing. And it's like, if someone comes up to you and you know your house is valued at $1 million, and someone comes to you frantically the next day and is offering you $700,000, and because you know the market's going down and things are going crazy, like, are you going to sell it just because he came knocking to your door? You know the value of the house, it's $1 million. Why are you going to give it a $300,000 discount? The same thing with the market. One day, if someone comes knocking and they say that like it's on a red day and it goes down, obviously it's concerning, and that is a bit more of a dramatic decrease because it's 30%. It just kind of goes to the effect, like, if you know the value of your stock, if you know the value of your home, if you know the value of any asset, and the asset can even be like for yourself, like if you want to go and coach someone and they're, you know your price, and they want to undercut you and they want to push you down, like, this is the value and this is why it's worth the value. And if you can explain that, then you keep pushing through. So that's another thing. But part of like going back to value is, especially when we're young, there's such a huge opportunity that we have to build ourselves of our net worth and of equity. And by that, I mean home equity. I'm actually very lucky that my parents, like, they lived very humbly. I grew up like a princess, my sister and I. My parents always did everything to sacrifice for me and her. We didn't live in a lavish home. We didn't have a pool in the backyard. We didn't have like the most luxurious vacations, if at all. It was just like a very like peaceful life, whatever we could do to just like meet ends and go about things. But the best thing my dad ever did in his entire life was, even when things were tough, he bought a house. And he bought a house because he told himself like he needs a house to build the equity and to have something in his name. He kind of regrets that he didn't do it as early. Like, we kind of lived in rent for the first 10 years of my life, and then he finally bought a house. And that was his most proudest achievement, because that house has actually like helped him so tremendously. It was the best return on investment he could have ever asked for, because we lived at this house, which was a bungalow, was nothing extreme. It's gotten like a 4x return. And if he still stayed here, he would have still continued to ride that wave. So there's actually this reality and fact that being homeowners makes the most amount of millionaires, at least in Canada, probably the world. I don't know. Maybe the housing market is not that crazy in other parts, but it's a fact. Housing and property, they're not making more of the land. Property is going to increase in value. Yes, it's going to have its like crazy markets, but I mean, at this point, like, I don't know how things are ever going to slow down in the market. And once you start having ownership and you start having a home, the equity that you can build upon us can allow you to really elevate your net worth and your entire income. From whatever my dad bought the price at like 17 years ago is literally peanuts today. And he's built so much home equity that he can now have a fabulous retirement, which was the entire goal of why I wanted to become a homeowner at 24 and give him his dream home while having the opportunity to not maybe retire right away, but he has the options to like explore for that as soon as possible, because he made that one decision where he stayed humble. He wasn't wasting his money on like luxury vacations or Disneyland every single month or every year, because he couldn't. He instead sacrificed a lot so that over these past 17 years, he can at least retire at a point where he wants and doesn't need to have that stress. That's another really key piece, that home ownership is literally the biggest transfer of wealth, that really it goes unbeat unless you're lucky to get a GMC, GameStop type of thing.
Yeah. Really growing that money tree as you so perfectly said at the beginning. And I'd be curious to ask as well, you do a lot of clubhousing, or is that even the term, clubhousing?
I have no idea.
I don't know. I know you go on Clubhouse a lot and talk about this. So I'd be curious to hear maybe some like the top questions that are frequently asked in those chats in regards to financing and wealth.
To be honest, like I actually don't touch upon like finance within Clubhouse originals because I haven't been on it. But most of the questions that I actually usually get on Clubhouse is always around cryptocurrency, which is actually interesting. Yes. We didn't touch upon it that much so far. Honestly, like I'm a very big fan of cryptocurrency. And if you want to have diversification, you should have diversification. I can definitely say that I was a proud investor of Doge or Dogecoin back in 2017. And so I'm very happy with my returns when I took it, just because I loved Elon Musk. And I was like, yeah, let's do it, Elon. Let's be part of the prank. I just really like the whole decentralization of power in money. So I'm a huge advocate for what it stands for. I still think it has a long ways to go, and it's going to be interesting to see like how regulation may come into play. But El Salvador just made Bitcoin a legal currency. There's a lot of, you know, strides. Bitcoin and cryptocurrency as a whole has taken a big dip recently. If I'm being honest, I actually think it's a good thing, because the whole rise that really took a peak this past year or so was actually because of the stimulus checks, and people want just like riding the wave of Bitcoin, not really understanding it at the core. And like people are getting scared now because of like talks of like inflation and like talks of like being taxed and blah, blah, blah. But it's just like, if you understand the value of Bitcoin as a whole being a store of value, if you understand the value like Ethereum being having the options to make transactions like very seamlessly and like having other core values that fiat can't, then that's the biggest piece. And if you want a really good stat, because of COVID, inflation is going to go wild. And the dollar that we have today is going to be worth like probably 50 cents in another year. And that's a dramatic example, but it's actually because like they said that the current world money supply, anywhere between 40 to 60% was just most recently printed because of COVID. So that makes you really think that if my money is deflating in value because they keep printing more of it, like, what am I going to do? You need to be strategic and have money that's going to outperform inflation, which is why, again, like it always goes back to hesitancy. Are you going to be hesitant to keep your money in an account that's actually going to lose its value? Or are you going to be hesitant to actually diversify yourself in the world of stocks, in the world of cryptos, in the world of real estate investing, to actually outperform what's been inevitable of increasing inflation rates? That's what I would say is a very common topic.
Interesting. And it's funny that you bring that up too, because I actually came across this post. People can rationalize, and I'll go back to your example of 10,000. People can rationalize spending $10,000 on, I don't know if Gucci slides actually cost this, but let's just say they do. You know, $10,000 in Gucci slides, but they're hesitant to put $10,000 into the stock market, you know, 10,000, like $100,000 into like Lambo, which again, I'm probably getting all these numbers wrong because I'm not a very materialistic person, but you know, they're afraid to invest $100,000 on down payment on a house. You know, it's this area of prioritization where if you're having those conversations for yourself, like, yeah, I spent $10,000 on these Gucci slides, like, are your priorities really in place? And again, like, if that's something you've been working towards, like, all the power to you. But again, if you're looking for more, as we've been talking about this entire conversation, like, do you want the Gucci slides? Do you want the Gucci house? I think that's ultimately, it's a weird example. I don't know why I'm climbing up with it, but it's.
No, it's a very valid point. Part of the reason why I even went to credit card debt when I was like still in university. Well, no, I wasn't in credit card debt. I was in credit card debt because of my company at that time, but I went to credit card debt for a while. And it was like, I was just thinking like, no, like I'm going to make it because like I'm building a business and it's going to go really well. And then I kept thinking like everything's an investment. I bought like a luxury bag and I told myself this is an investment. It's going to go up in value. And it's true. It did. But I bought it on a credit card. And I remember thinking like, this is the dumbest thing I could have done. I could have actually invested the money, got a return, then bought the same Chanel bag and had extra to reinvest again.
Exactly.
So, but it's also like, you have to be lucky for those kinds of opportunities too. Like, not every bag you're going to buy, not every luxury item is going to retain its value. There's only a certain limited amount of designers that actually have that capability. And typically it requires you actually having to spend like 5,000 plus each time to even do something like that. In the case of Hermes, you need like at least 100,000 and a whole wait list. So again, it just becomes like, if you want to go buy the Gucci bag, my sister did it, and I keep putting it to her face. Like, she went and she spent $2,000, which is, again, if you want to do it and you save the money, you told yourself that was going to be the goal, go ahead and do it. But if you go in with just like just $2,000, like, you realize that you just wasted $2,000 because the resale value instantly went down. And even a year later, it's going to go even more down. Same concept when you buy a car. Once you take the car out of the dealership, it's lost half its value or something like that. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, it's always figuring out a way to how to combat your appreciating ads to those kinds of sunk costs. It's inevitable. You want to treat yourself. And I do treat myself regardless. And it's just being strategic of how you're outweighing it each time.
Well, I guess sort of a follow-up question, because I think, you know, something that's really important for like mental health and just for your like sanity is, as you said, like indulging in yourself and like treating yourself. Where do you draw that line though? Like, obviously, like, you have to be strategic, but like, I guess for you personally, how do you think about drawing that line? Because I know for some people, it's really hard, especially as you mentioned earlier, you can get your first job, you get a lot more money than you're probably used to.
Yeah, like, it was an entire new world, like, for me. Like, when I had my first paycheck, I was like, holy shit, I'm rich. Like, I'm balling here, and I'm literally going to do what I know. I was living in Montreal at the time. I was like, I'll cover my rent and I'll go like get myself this because I deserve it, because now I'm a big girl working in an incredible like global 100 company. I'm like doing a boss ass job and being a boss ass bitch. But then at the end of the day, when your credit card comes in, you're like, oh, like, shit, like, I fucked up. And you don't realize that until you're probably like had that flexibility, you just didn't know how to maintain yourself. And so it wasn't until I actually put myself into like a strict budget that I realized that I was very frivolous with my spending in a way that wasn't sustainable. But also, when I put myself on a budget, I actually was like, I didn't feel strict, if that makes sense, because I was very realistic and I was understanding that even though I'm not spending money on a shopping spree, I'm spending my money that's making me money to have that shopping spree and have the additional cash. So actually, my favorite thing is at the end of every month, I go back to my expenses. I have my budget outlined. And I'm like, oh, actually, like, instead of me just like feeling bad and like nervous every single time I go and swipe my credit card, I actually know that I have like $200-$300 of a budget for clothing that I can spend versus feeling bad every weekend, spending like $70 here, $50 there. And at the end of the day, it mounts up to like a $600 bill, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's like, oh, this is exciting. I have $300 to burn, because that's, I allow myself that. And I don't feel guilty about it too. So it's all the whole mix of like having the budget where you don't feel guilty anymore, you can enjoy shopping again, and you still have money on the side. Like, for me, it's just like the best of both worlds that makes it actually really fun to go shopping again, where it's not guilty anymore.
An overarching theme to this is you got to go in head first, but you got to like plan as well. It's pretty important to understand like how much you can actually afford, because you go into, and I don't know why I'm using Gucci, sponsor me, come on. like, go in, like, spend $10,000, like, do you know you have money, like, again, the emergency fund, or like for other things? Like, are you going to go have mimosas after? You're going to go out for a nice lunch? Do you have the money for that? Who knows? So plan. And I guess sort of just on that point as well, like budgeting and planning, you know, for someone who's interested in furthering their career in finance, whether that's on the side or professionally, what advice would you have for them?
Overarching piece of advice that just summarizes like literally this entire conversation is A, to get started, because even if you think you're ready, you're probably not. There's more than just like the educational part of it. There's a whole mental toughness behind this. Like, even if you had the best analysis and you made like a whole kind of like report on why you need to invest in this stock, or why you need to invest in this crypto, or why you need to buy certain things that will have a return, you never know. No one predicted COVID. No one predicted many different things, and things will go up and down. And what's funny is that if you look at the stock market, they did a test.
Oh, I know what you're about to say.
They told like a group of monkeys, like, I don't know what they did. Like, basically they told them like to point, or I don't know how
throw a dart.
Because yeah, but how does a monkey throw a dart? I don't know. There's some complexities behind that. But like, let's just say like they threw a dart, whatever. They had more accuracy than the top financial associates and investment analysts on Wall Street. Let that sink in a bit, because like monkeys outperform Wall Street. Wall Street is supposed to be the empire behind like financial education, financial excellence. And if a monkey could outperform them, like why do you think you can outperform the analysts, the Wall Street? Like good for you if you can, like that's obviously the goal, but they have dedicated their lives to this. They have millions, if not billions and trillions of dollars to work around, and they still get it wrong. And that's the point that I want to make, and is that there's never going to be a perfect timing. There's never going to be a perfect stock. You're going to lose some, you're going to win some. But at the end of the day, it's literally just getting in, getting your mindset and reality to the opportunity and acceptance of money and inflow of money and just the betterment of your own financial health and financial wealth. That's the biggest piece like that I can just really emphasize. And it's still something that I have to tell myself every single day as well. It's the same thing like what we're told on an everyday basis. Like you have to always consistently have deliberate practice with yourself. You need to make yourself mentally tough each and every day. Like that's why even the best of athletes, they all warm up before every big game. Right now with the NBA playoffs right now, you still see everyone stretching. Like it's a mandatory thing. And why is it that you can't have the same mentality when you go and buy a stock? Do the warm up, do the quick research, figure out why this is a good investment. It's simple things that make such a big difference. And simplest best practices just to take every single thing you do, whether it's with investing or anything else.
Well, Vaz, this has been an incredible conversation. I know I've taken a lot out of this conversation today. I guess the only other thing I'd like to ask you is if there's anything you would have liked me to ask or talk about today in our conversation.
I guess like my biggest question is that, did you learn something new? And did I at least bring some value? Because I feel like I just constantly like take in as much information as possible. I try to share as much as I can, because the reality, and it's unfortunate, like I am probably one of the lucky ones, so to say, in the sense that like I didn't come from like a privileged background, but I try to pave a path that I could, at least to my greatest abilities to this point, that is still a starting point for me. Like I still have a long ways to go, but if there's something that I can pass on to someone else that they didn't know, like maybe it was like the taxable credit, maybe it was like building home equity, maybe it was even just like using OSAP for like to build up your credit score, like the simplest things. Or actually I didn't mention this either, but like one of the things that I am thankful that my dad did was that at 16 years old, right when I turned 16, he co-signed me on a credit card to start building my credit from there too. So just there's such small little things that like that make such a huge difference, like whether you are immigrant, first gen, or like even have the rich daddy and the rich fund, like what can you take ownership from today? And if that was a value, like I would love to know, because it just makes sure that like what I'm done so far is something that can be passed off.
I love that. And again, I know you had mentioned in our conversation, you follow a lot of influencers and a lot of people who delve into areas you're interested in investing in. So would love to open up the floor to you, and for our listeners, where can they follow you?
They can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at V Bellegrinas. My name is very Greek, so it's VBELGRINIS. And then on TikTok, you can find me at Passions to Profits. It's not the number 2, it's just the actual letters T-O. But if you find me on my Instagram, it's all linked there as well. So I'm excited that hopefully you guys can come into my DMs, ask me any further questions that you have from this entire conversation, because hopefully you can tell that there is some passions here that could lead you guys to profits.
Damn. Great financier and great salesperson. I love it. But that's it for this week, Truth Seekers. And again, Vaz Leaky, thank you so much for coming on. And thank you all for your ongoing support as per usual and your feedback. For us, please feel free to continue following us and recommend our channel and our podcast at We Want the Truth Pod on Instagram and We Want the Truth on Spotify, iTunes, and all streaming channels. And we'll talk about the truth on something else next time.